My name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Just press play, right? There we go. Very grateful to be here. Love Feet First Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember the first time I came here, the meeting was outside. Got a real feel for the meeting, some of the energy that happens in here, and I've gotten to know some of its members very well, and have become close friends and have ran around Alcoholics Anonymous up and down the East Coast with a lot of them, different states, different places, campouts, step workshops, and I've had a lot of experiences with the members of Feet First, and they certainly have played a part in, you know, why I'm able to here today to be able to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope with you guys about what Alcoholics Anonymous has been like in my life. I'd like to thank the guys who came down with me, two of my sponsees, one of my grand sponsees. We hop in vehicles, we go all over the place also, and we know we're alcoholics. You know, we proved it to ourselves on the way here. I mean, we have full cups of coffee, but we're pulling into Wawa to get more coffee, right? We decide that we're going to get a donut. We walk inside. One walks inside. He says, there's no donuts. I say to him, I'm going to go in. I'm going to find a donut. I go in. The guy's restacking the donuts, right? So I go out and I go, come here. We go in. So everybody's going to get a donut. And very quickly, my mind adds up when I start looking around that instead of buying three donuts for $3 in some sense, we can get six donuts for $3. So I very quickly talk him into getting six donuts instead of three donuts. We then proceed to go outside, set the donuts on top of the garbage can. We're all standing around the garbage can, drinking the coffee, eating the donuts. Nobody could throw their trash away. It's like we own Wawa, right? Talking to each other about, we're all sitting there diagnosing each other with diabetes. Now, only alcoholics do that kind of stuff. I mean, and especially laugh and have a good time at it. That's what's the best part about it. It was like we were right where we were supposed to be, doing exactly what we were supposed to be doing. It couldn't have felt any better, honest to God. And, you know, the reason I tell that story, which I could tell you a million of them, is like, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is like in my life today. I go to places. I'm with people. You know, some of the most unusual stuff happens that we do not plan to do. And why it can seem so corny and off the wall to everybody else, it's right where we're supposed to be. Feeling the way we're supposed to be feeling, talking the way we're supposed to be talking, doing what we're supposed to be doing. I can guarantee you that's not what it used to be like. Okay? Whether it was in Alcoholics or out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, I remember for a long time I would come into Alcoholics Anonymous and take up the seat and be sitting with 100 of you people and didn't feel like I was connected to any of you. You know, I can remember every time I would have conversations with people, I was so worried about what you thought of me and comparing myself to you and everything else that what would come flying out of my mouth would probably absolutely have no truth because I kind of felt like I had to lie to be a part of, you know. And I lived my life like that for a long time, you know, and one of the greatest things about Alcoholics Anonymous is it set me free from that stuff. It really has set me free from that stuff. I do not compare myself to anybody. You know, my sponsor tells me, you know, it's none of my business what you think. You know, I've really learned a lot of things along the way in Alcoholics Anonymous that lets me practice a lot of the principles they talk about, love and tolerance, and, you know, use some of the barometers and check balances that I've learned through my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, a big barometer for me the way I know how I'm doing with me and my own personal spiritual condition is when I'm amongst you, can I let you be who you are? Can I let you have your experience in Alcoholics Anonymous? Can I understand that you have your own God and you're where you're supposed to be and my only job is to be loving, tolerant, and keep myself in a position of availability to be of help if I can? Yeah. I can guarantee you I wasn't doing that for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. It took a lot of pain. It took a lot of discomfort. It took a lot of, you know, me cutting my nose to spite my own face, sober. Not only drunk, but sober. To learn some of the lessons I've learned and been able to grow spiritually in this program. And I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink since August 20th, 1998. I'm very grateful for that. I will guarantee you it was necessary for me to pick up a drink before that. absolutely necessary. Could not go a day without sitting in my own skin and the world around me with such levels of uncomfortability that I had to pour drink on it. You know, so I'm not a problem drinker, I'm an answer drinker. Okay? I drink because it answers something that I'm unable to answer sober. You know. I ran around Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time trying to solve the wrong problem. I thought my problem was drinking. You know? And I thought once I put down drink that life would kind of straighten itself out. And you know what? Probably one of the greatest illusions that happens in life is that when I do put down drink, there are some things in my life that get better that I will judge myself that I am well by. You know, for me, if I'm employed, that's a big one. Man, I'm really doing good. Yeah. People are letting me in their door to visit. That's a huge one. You know what I mean? If my parents are talking to me, invite me to the house. That's huge. If they tell me I can sleep there at night, man, I'm living beyond my wildest dreams. You know, but I can get all that stuff going on, you know, because when I put down drink, you know, I get that glow back in my face, you know, I get a little healthied up. People are able to be around me a little more. It's not like people aren't locking their doors and hiding everything and all that kind of stuff. And for me, you know, I'm a real low bottom drinker, man. I'm like, there's nothing underneath my drinking. My drinking is my low bottom and everything that comes with it. And when you pull drink or drug for me, I kind of step up in here right above it. And for me, this is like VIP. Because this is not normally what I have going on in my life. I'm usually always here. So when I get this and I get happy with this, I can crookedly rest my laurels on the fact that that's as good as it's supposed to be. And for me, one of the things I've learned numerous times, because I'm not a first-time winner at this, is that I show up. I show up right in the midst of why all that stuff is getting good. You know, and when I show up, I sabotage everything. You know, because my motives and agendas aren't right, I'm still extremely selfish and self-centered. I'm still fearful as heck. I'm still worried about what you think of me. I'm still comparing myself to you. I'm living by such a life of self-propulsion that I've now made my life about all my external circumstances, and I have completely forgotten what Alcoholics Anonymous is really about, and that's treating the internal condition. And I have no choice. It's only a matter of time for me. Tick, 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 tick. You know, and what happens, and I don't know, I really didn't know this until hindsight, is that I start to live my life by what I don't lose, not how I'm living with what I have. So as long as I'm still in the house and I still have the kid and I still have the job, life is grand, you know? And for a guy like me, like, I'm still telling myself everything's grand after I lose everything. So for me, it becomes a real suffering way of life, you know? And I'm just really grateful I don't have to live like that anymore. I'm really grateful that I understand how Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me put the puzzle together. Because my life is also very puzzling all the time. I don't know about you guys, but it just seemed like things were all over the place, and I lacked this incredible ability to reach out and grab them all and put them together and say, okay, this is what it is. I mean, I could never seem to understand what it was, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me the opportunity to pull the pieces together. Not only has it afforded me the opportunity to pull the pieces together, but it also made me real aware that my job isn't to create more pieces while I put the pieces together that I'm already trying to figure out. Because that's another big problem I have. Why I couldn't figure the puzzle out, I'm always throwing more pieces out there to a puzzle I can't figure out. You know. And thank God that doesn't happen in my life anymore. You know, and, you know, I'm here to report to you that, figuring that out has been a long journey in Alcoholics Anonymous sober, learning the hard way. Really, really learning the hard way. I would love to tell you guys that after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not coming, after arriving at Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1978, that it's been a journey of really good understanding and you know, a forthfulness of willingness and all that kind of stuff that goes along with being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm here to report to you as I talk to you about my story that You know, I was 9, 10 years sober. This pastime in Alcoholics Anonymous, still hurting people, still selfish and self-centered, still having some bad motives and agendas in certain areas of my life. And this is after this thing has almost killed me 2 or 3 times. And this last time, not thinking I was ever going to get a chance to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that, you know, I like in our reading where it says, remember that we deal with alcoholism, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. That was my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, multiple times before this last time, and even up to about 9 years of this time, is that I still avoided that statement to a degree of what it really takes to get in the kind of depth and understanding that I feel that I have with a power greater than myself and who I am in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Where they say pain is mandatory, suffering is optional, right? But they say pain is a touchstone to spiritual growth, you know. So I know there's things I'm going to have to go through that I'm going to feel, and they're going to be painful. You know, my job is to not turn it into suffering. Is to take those moments, trust in God, clean whatever house I need to, always throw myself deeper into service, helping other alcoholics, so I stand a chance of not turning what that pain is into suffering. The object is to never run around Alcoholics Anonymous and think I'm not going to experience pain. You know, if you'd have told me that my life was going to be the way it is today, right now, in Alcoholics Anonymous 5 years ago, I'd have asked you if you fell down and bumped your head. I really would have. I could never have thought that where I'm at today, I would be at doing what I'm doing today. I've always had this underlying selfish and self-centeredness that made it so much about me, that I never thought I could get to a point to where I could put me aside and throw myself into helping the life of others in the situation I'm currently in right now and be so totally okay with it. You know, to understand that this is what God wants me to do. This is what God says to Jim, it's time to go do this. And for me to say, okay, I get it. I understand. It's not an inconvenience. It's not a what about me. It's not a, well, how am I gonna? It's a, okay, God, let me suit up and show up, and let me do what I got to do because this is the gift that you gave me to give back. And man, I'm here to tell you, it's been a lot of work. It's been a lot of work. And to tell you, just to qualify a little bit about, you know, being this thing called alcoholic, you know, last thing I ever wanted to be was alcoholic. There's two really specific reasons why I never wanted to be alcoholic. I didn't know it then. I know it now clearly beyond a doubt. One is my father was alcoholic. He was the man I swore I would never be like. Okay. I was highly affected by his untreated alcoholism. Is it what makes me alcoholic? Absolutely not. Was he a wonderful blaming mechanism for a lot of years over pouring out? I poured alcohol in for a long time thinking he was the reason why I turned out like I did. You know, I'm here to report to you today that that's absolutely not true. But I was affected by his untreated alcoholism. And I talked a little bit earlier about how I was affected. You know, my dad was the kind of guy that, he was the doctor and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that the book talks about. You know, he would be one guy early in the morning. It would seem like he would be that thing called dad where he would like play with me and it was cool and I kind of enjoyed him, and he smiled, and it seemed like he seemed to be interested in me. And all of a sudden, that clock would hit a certain time, and I didn't exist. He would go up, he'd go put his coat on, he'd roll out the door. You would not see him all day. You would not see him most of the night. And then all of a sudden, that door would come flying open late in the night, and he'd come through the doorway, and he was fundamentally like a different man. He didn't smell the same. He didn't sound the same. He didn't look the same. And he certainly didn't act the same. And I had a mother who was a little 4'11" Italian lady. And when my dad would come home drunk, she would turn into like 6 foot. Right? And she would poke him in the chest and try to tell him about his drinking. And he had a method. He had a method how he handled things. He would come in and she'd start poking him in the chest, and he'd push her to the side, and he'd take a couple steps, and she'd come back around, and then he'd kind of take a piece of furniture and throw it, and that wouldn't stop her, and then he'd push her to the ground, and that wouldn't stop her, and then My dad actually had a bigger problem than blackout drinking. He had blackout anger. He would get to the point to where he would get pushed so far and snap. And for a kid like me, you know, I had to find a safe place in the house. My safe place was under the bed. And I can remember being under that bed. But like at the edge of it, just kind of wanting to know what was going on, even though I knew what was going on. You know, and on a good day, when he wouldn't come out of his blackout anger out there, he would come into the room and he'd reach under and grab me and I'd become a part of the scenery. And, you know, as a young kid, man, you walk around like really confused about what the heck's going on in your house and with your dad. And I'm at an age where I haven't pieced together that he has a problem with drinking. I just thought it was him, you know, and, you know, that's certainly not what makes me alcoholic. But I can tell you, there came a time later in life when I took a drink that it answered a lot of those questions. Because what my life was like from his untreated alcoholism until I drank and got that sense of ease and comfort with some things was, my life was like when I would leave my house, I talked about it. I would automatically compare myself to you and I never measured up. Okay. I always worried about what you thought about me. I had to become a liar. I had to tell you stories because I could not let you know what was going on in my home. You know, you would say, hey, me and my dad did this. I say, oh, yeah, me and my dad did that too. I would, you know, I got so kind of like used to it and kind of like it became so habitual and like a routine in my life that I was just prepared to tell stories. And it got to the point where I would one up the story. Like my life was even a little better than the story you just told. You know, and, you know, I didn't know it then. I know clearly today that it was riddled with fear. And fear would run my life. And my biggest fear is that you would all get together and find out all the stories I told you that weren't true. And then nobody would want to be around me or like me. And I would have no place to be. You know? And I walked around that with that for a long time. Until that day where I was in that place with those people and that thing came up. And I took a drink, and it did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It basically started to answer some things that I was looking for answers for about how I felt and the way I thought for a lot of years. So, you know, from that moment on, it was a full-time job with unlimited overtime. To me, it was a solution. You know, to me, it was get up every day, plan, chase, get, do, so that I could try to have this sense of ease and comfort about what it felt like when I didn't have it. You know? And, you know, they talk about, like, when did you cross the line, this, that, and the other. And you know what? I don't even debate that. I used to at one time. I don't even debate the fact that it isn't about when I crossed the line. You know, for me, it's really about when I got to a point where I would depend on this thing as a solution to everything in my life every day, and it started to manufacture a lot of other stuff along with it that I was unable to look at or able to want to look at to kind of see that I was still taking the raw end of a bargain when it came into my relationship with alcohol. And I was willing to pay that price. You know, I was willing, I was willing to get arrested. You know, I was willing to steal and get caught. I was willing to lie and get caught. You know, I was willing to do a lot of things and get caught and pay consequences behind the fact that when I would do this thing, it would still seem to answer some questions. You know, and one of the greatest things about untreated alcoholism is alcohol turns on us. You know, and when it turns on me, I'm getting drunk, but it's not answering anything anymore. You know, as a matter of fact, it's starting to talk to me in a new kind of way. I can't shut the noise up and it gets louder and louder. And it turns on me, and you know what happens to me internally is a real bad place to be, man. Real, real bad place to be, you know. Like, to talk about it, I can't imagine life with a drink or without a drink, you know. You know, I'm in that spot that is a real bad spot, you know. You know, the first time I ever went to Alcoholics Anonymous was back in 1978, which is a pretty long time ago. I was not in that meeting on purpose. I often tell this story because it's my first impression I had of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in a jail in Bucks County. I was 18. And a guy popped his head in my cell about 7 o'clock at night and said there was free donuts and free coffee in the cafeteria. And if it's free, it's for me. And I got this plan very, very quickly together in my mind that I was going to go to this cafeteria, I was going to put this jacket on, and I was going to get as many donuts in the right pocket, as many donuts in the left pocket, I was going to get a big old cup of coffee, I was going to come back to my cell, I was going to lay in my bunk, I was going to turn the TV on, I was going to watch a movie, I was going to eat those donuts, and I was going to get crumbs all over my chest, and I was going to have the best damn day in jail I ever had. That was my plan. I don't know about you guys. I got this. I can see it now in hindsight. I've always had this power greater than me that's had its hand on me that lets me think I'm getting away with stuff. And all of a sudden goes, yank. It's a lesson learned here, yank. And that was one of those moments because I got to that cafeteria and I got those donuts and I got that cup of coffee. And I was headed for that gate. And that damn guy with that uniform. This guy with these uniforms keeps showing up in my life, but this guy with this uniform shows up, and he says, where are you going? And I try to tell him, and he goes, nah, movement's occurred. You got to go sit in the back row for the meeting. And I said, what meeting? And he said, the A meeting. And I looked at him, and I said, well, what's an A meeting? And he just kind of looked at me like a lot of people have looked at me, that corny look, you know what I mean? Told me, go have a seat in the back row. Don't make any noise. It'll be over in an hour. Then you go back to your cell, do whatever you want. And I can remember standing there. And the feeling I used to have under the bed when my dad was blacked out, I was having standing in front of this guy. It would start in my stomach, it would go to my chest, it would go to my neck, up to my head, it would panic my thought process. I was realizing I was not getting what I want when I wanted it. Things weren't turning out my way. That does not sit well with me. I look at the guy who told me the donuts were free. I'm getting ready to punch him out because these donuts are not free. There are big prices to pay for these donuts, right? And I go disgruntledly over and I sit in the back row and I watch these guys walk in, people we would identify as old timers, and they sit down and they open this here A&A thing up to whatever they're doing and they begin to talk, which I understand today is qualified, and I look at the guy next to me and I go, you're kidding me, right? What losers would come into a jail on a Saturday night at 7 o'clock and tell their drunken stories? They have no life. They ain't got nothing better to do. You're kidding me, right? And I can remember in that back seat, that back row, I can definitely identify probably every character defect that came up on my four step that I eventually did. Just sitting in that chair in that hour that night. I was judgmental. I was prejudiced. I was opinionated. I had it all going on, right? And then finally I heard the words of relief. We're going to end the meeting. I was like, oh, thank God. And I got up and I ran for that gate and that guy with that uniform popped in front of me and he's pointing. I don't know what he's pointing at because everybody's behind me. So I turn around, everybody's standing in a circle. I thought, oh, I must have to go stand in a circle. So I take off for the circle and I come up with my next big problem. Guys are holding guys' hands in jail. And guys do not hold guys' hands in jail, right? So I go over and I do what I think I should do and I throw the pinkies out. And I look at this guy and I look at this guy, like, don't touch the pinky, right? You know, I am like 18 years old. I am so full of fear. I am so full of everything. You know, my reaction to everything is like crazy and like somewhat leading towards devastational. And I'm standing there with my pinkies out, and they begin to say the Lord's Prayer. And I don't know it. My name is James Joseph Anthony. I should probably know the Lord's Prayer a little bit, right? I don't know. So I do what I do, and I don't know what I know. I put my head down, and I go, blah, 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 blah. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Come on now, right? I start mumbling, acting like I know something I don't know. That's not new to us, right? Acting like we know something we don't know, right? And, you know, I walk away from there and, you know, I got one thought in my mind. No matter whatever happens in my life, I will never return to this thing called A&A. I've been scarred. I've been scarred. This thing called A&A has scarred me. Well, I'm here to report to you some many years later. You know, I've had a lot of experiences running in and out of AA and, you know, kind of being directed by a lot of other people, because that's a part of my untreated alcoholism. Part of my untreated alcoholism is I always wind up in a position where people have to run my life for me, because they consider it to be not only be a danger to myself, but it is a danger to others in society as a whole. So I get things like judges and parole officers and all these people in my life who kind of guide me around to make sure I'm not hurting anything, or, you know, or I'm not committing any of this new stuff that I just previously committed. And this is what my life looks like. So, you know, I have a probation experience, I have a parole experience, I have a detox experience, I have an inpatient experience, I have an outpatient experience, you know, I have a psychiatrist experience, I have a psychologist experiences. I'm having all these wonderful experiences of how you get directed around to eventually somebody saying along the journey, okay, Jim, we're going to give you a chance. We're going to give you a shot. It'll have a lot of strings attached to it because we just ain't giving you a free shot. But we're going to give you a shot with some strings attached to it to show that maybe you're ready to do this a little differently than you used to do it. And I would get excited about it because I'm looking for a shot. I'm always looking for a shot, right? Except part of the shot was they would always tell me, you have to make sure you go back to A&A. And I would be like, no, don't you know what happened to me? I've been scarred by A&A. And they would give me the look like the guard gave me, and they say, no, Jim, you need to go to AA. You know, so, you know, the reason I share that story with you is because, you know, my first impressions of Alcoholics Anonymous was a place that, one, I didn't want to be, two, I didn't feel I belonged, three, I wasn't even willing to see if I could relate to anything you said. You know, so I had blocked this all off. Even though I was physically there, every other part of me was blocked off from anything that was happening at these numerous attempts of walking in and out of AA or, you know. And plus, I had one other big thing going on. In this brain, when left untreated, can get itself to believe anything, 110%. My thought was, this was just another place I was sentenced to. I always felt like I was sentenced to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It just seemed like, it just seemed in a way like a lesser sentence because it didn't have bars and you know, it was somewhat a little free, like street clothes, and, you know, it seemed like I had a little choice going on that I felt like I could have control over, but deep down inside, I was always felt like I was sentenced to be here. So I would come to your meetings because I had to, because the alternative was jail. You know, and I'd hit a point in my life where I was tired of being in jail, but I didn't know anything about what my problem was or anything I needed to do if I was going to come to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, which meant I was coming here making my own stuff up. And what it would look like for me to make my own stuff up in Alcoholics Anonymous would be, I would come in, I would take up the chair, I would not let any of you get too close to me. I really didn't want to let you know who I was. I really wasn't interested in knowing who you were unless you had something that I wanted, or I could get something from you that would make me feel good. So I basically would come in and I would eat your coffee. I mean, drink your coffee. I would eat your cookies. Certainly would attempt to date your girls. I was always looking for a hostage in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? A victim. I was looking for a victim that would love me so much that she would help try to manage my life. You know what I mean? And while she was doing it, I would try to convince her that, that I really cared about her. And, you know, much like anything else we do in life, when the motives and genders are wrong, I can only do that for so long before, you know, not only do they know it's not working the way it's supposed to be working, but I absolutely get sick of having to do it. You know what I mean? I get sick of having to try to pull the scam off, you know, and the thing that I absolutely don't want to do, but I'll do it because it's all I'm left with to do, you know. So I would come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I would go in and out of a lot of places, you know, because I would make all the stops along the way of you know, different jails and different rehabs and a lot of different places. And, you know, eventually, you know, I got out of a rehab in 1988, Eagleville Hospital. And I loved Eagleville Hospital. You know, I went to a penitentiary for quite a long time, and part of my parole plan was I had to go to treatment. After they let me out of jail, so they sent me to Eagleville. And back then, They used to give you long-term treatment. They actually sent me there for 6 months, and I don't know why it is that they seem to lock you up a little heavier when you're on your way out than when you're on your way. And I went to Eagleville. I was strapped all up, and I'm like, I pull up, and I remember it was like a college campus. I was like, oh my God, this is so beautiful. And I can remember pulling up to the front door, and there were some girls standing under a tree. And they made a really bad mistake. They smiled at me. Not good. I haven't seen a girl in about 7.5 years. And you smile at me? I'm not even out of the car, and we've had sex. We're married. We might have a girlfriend. Because it's what I do, man. You know what I mean? Like, it's part of my untreated problem, you know? And it's great because they smiled at me, and I think I'm the stuff. So, you know, I hop out the car because, you know, I'm all shackled at the ankles, right? And I'm over, and I'm trying to wave to them like this because I care, right? And they're all smiling a little bigger, and I'm thinking, yeah, they like me even more. And, you know, my mind's doing what it's doing, right? And the director of the program comes up and tells me to come up in his office, and he says, oh, you're going to be a fun time here, huh? I go, what are you talking about? He goes, you aren't even out the car and look at you with the girls. He said, I got to immediately put you on female blackout. I was like, really? He goes, well, I can send you back to the penitentiary. I said, I'll take female blackout, right? I was willing to take the deal, right? I didn't need to phone a friend or anything about it. I was taking the deal, right? So, you know, here I am at 6 months in this program, and you know, I knew one thing for sure. I didn't want to go back to jail. I was starting to hear some things about what recovery was about. You know, they would make you go to AA meetings and NA meetings and different meetings. And people were saying stuff. And for the first time, some of it sounded interesting. Some of it identified with, you know, a lot of it I underestimated the power of what they were saying. Just wasn't sinking in, you know. I didn't know why then. I know why today. You know, I was in that place, and I really wasn't willing to still take a look at what that first step was really about, you know. I didn't even want to take a word what that second word in our first step really looked about, you know. Because if I can't do anything with that second word in that first step, I can't do anything in this program. You know, if I can't draw a final fact or conclusion and say this is it, I don't really believe I need to get any help or do anything that you want me to do, because I don't think it's it. You know, and I'm certainly not willing to take a look at my problem as truly powerlessness. You know what I mean? Because I'm too busy not looking at that second word, thinking I still got the power, that I'm not really it, that I could be something else. And that's where I was at, you know, and they sent me out of there. And after, I remember, like, I had like 3 weeks left. They're like, Jim, you got to go in 3 weeks. Where are you going? And I'm like, I don't want to go. This is the best my life has ever been. Do I really have to leave? Like, I was okay with being sentenced to Eagleville. Gave me a place to sleep. They fed me. There were girls. I mean, I was living the dream. It was the best my life ever was, you know? But they said, no, you got to go. You know, and I went back to Easton, PA, and I went to my first AA meeting, and I walked up on the porch, and, you know, I don't know, man. People have been around a long time. You just know. We just know when these new people are walking in, man. It's like they're dripping blood, and we're like sharks, man. You're like, whoosh, take off for them to go talk to them. And that's what happened to me when I went to my first meeting. And I walked up in this porch, and like four people started walking around. I'm like, yo, I don't know you like that. Like, really? Like, there's something about to happen here. You keep stepping forward, you know? Because that's how I deal with everything. I can't let you up in here. You know what I mean? It's a mess up in here. I know it's a mess up in here. I know I haven't even come to terms with what's up in here. So you can bet for sure I'm not letting you up in there, which means I need to do something to keep you out in here. Where I come from, I used to keep you out here. You know, and it sounds jailish, and it's intimidating, and it's the look, you know, and it's a lot of different things until I get you to make the move I want you to make. And once you make the move, then I go about my business of trying to do whatever is my next move is. My next move was, I know I need to be there. I'm going to jail. So I go into this meeting. And I walk away from that meeting saying, you know what, I think I can go back again. And I had a higher power at that time. It's called a state parole officer. He had the power, and I knew it. And I swore under all conditions I would follow the disciplines of that higher power so that I didn't go back to jail, which meant since I had to still walk off about another 8 years of parole, that I had to be with you guys being the biggest chameleon and con job I could possibly be to still remain with you and not go back to jail. Once again, sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous, taken up the chair with all the wrong motives and agendas. What did that look like? That looked like me going to meetings all over the place, throwing myself heavily into Alcoholics Anonymous, burglarizing your conversations and going to other meetings and talk about it like I made it up. You know, it would be, it would basically just really be about just trying to get 8 years to go by till this cat would leave my life, man. And the longer I stayed and the more I did it, on one side it got easier to do it, on the other side it got harder to be with you because you all started to see who I really was. And that's a real uncomfortable place to be, is in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous saying I'm one person but acting like I'm another. And the result of that is I'm still not trying to solve the right problem. I'm trying to solve the state parole officer problem, you know? So eventually, at 8 years, this guy walks away from my life. Yay, I think. And I figure out in this mind, see, I think with alcoholic, I have this alcoholic thinking, right? I don't know, it makes sense to me. I don't know about you guys when I'm in the midst of it. And my alcoholic is that, you know, Jim, look at this. Like, he's out of your life. He did this. You know, you've gained some things in your life. You're employable. You know, you got a girlfriend. Your parents are talking to you. You know, maybe you don't need to, like, go to Alcoholics Anonymous as much as you were. And I begin to walk away from AA. Even while I'm in it doing the wrong thing, I walk away from it. And I find out, surprisingly, that I can find a way to have a bigger problem in my mind with being in Alcoholics Anonymous than I can with taking that drink. And I've taken the one thing that could save my life, even though I'm sitting in the middle of it doing the absolute wrong thing. Now I take myself completely out of it, so I stand no chance whatsoever of maybe being in a position where I could hear or see or have something happening around me that could spark something or at least get me to look at something in a different way. Right? And I used to have this supermarket down the street from my house. I don't care what you tell me, it was an AA supermarket. Because every time I go in it, everybody from AA would be in it. Now, I'm not even drinking. And this is what my life looks like. I walk into the supermarket. I see you in aisle 13. I duck so you don't see me. I turn, I run to aisle 1, get as far away as I can from you. Because I'm not trying to run into you. Because you were always asking me those two questions. The ones I absolutely had to lie about. How you doing and where you been? And I copyrighted the answers. Okay? Everybody would get the same one. I'm doing fine and I've been busy. But for some reason, you had your own copyright. Because then you would say that third thing that would make me like want to punch you. You would look at me so peaceful and serene and go, give me a call sometime, I'll take you to a meeting. I'd be like, oh, it would be like the dagger. You know, and I would get all resentful and disgruntled. And I would try to live by self-propulsion and try to prove him more that I really didn't need you and the meeting you want to pick me up to go to. And while I'm doing all this, I'm spinning my decision-making and my moves and my motives and agendas into, you know, basically having no solution whatsoever. And, you know, my thinking really changes. And how it looks, how my thinking changes is when I'm at my job, you know, I don't think my employer treats me good enough. I think he takes advantage of me. You know, when I'm with my family, they just seem to be asking too many hard questions. They're too opinionated. They seem like they're, like, after me and out to get me, so I got to stop seeing them so much. I have a little boy that I'm his father and I'm taking too, and he's kind of getting away. of my free spirit life that I want to go live, because I'm already, well, I don't think so. I'm already ready to go drink again. And he's in the way, and I know it. And I have this girl that has hung out with me and has helped me raise my son, and she has a daughter, and I get this house in my name, and she's living in it, and now she's in my way. So one day I come home and say, "You gotta go." She's like, "Huh?" I'm like, "Nah, you really gotta go." And I'm destroying everything around me. I'm not even drinking. You know? And then eventually I put myself in a situation where it's me and a drink and I have no defense against it. And I drink. You know? And I start to tell myself things like, you know, "Jim, maybe you're not really alcoholic. Maybe your problem's drugs. If you leave the drugs alone, maybe you could do some managed drinking." And I try it. And then I say, "Maybe you can do some managed smoking weed." And then I say, "Maybe you can manage some cocaine in there with it." And then I say, "Maybe you can manage selling the stuff and be your own best customer." Because that's what it basically turns into. You know, and within a year to a year and a half, I'm in full blown. I'm not even at my house anymore. I'm running in the hood every day. I got family looking for me. I haven't contacted them in months. It's like Jim has just disappeared like he normally does when he does what he does. I'm in full-fledged. And I don't know how to turn around. I don't know how to stop. So whatever has to happen, has to happen. And this thing called the power greater than myself shows up again and does for me what I can't do for myself. It locks me up and puts me in a jail cell. It puts me in a position to where I have to start to have conversations with something that I can't see that is intangible, even in a begging way for help, because I'm ready to do a little listening now. You know, I have some qualities going on in my life right now that I don't know. You know, I have that gift of desperation now. You know, I've been beaten into a state of reasonableness where I'm talking to myself in a way I don't normally talk to myself. I have some fear going on, but it's not an immobilizing fear. It's actually a motivating fear where I'm saying to myself, "You know, Jim, if you can get another chance, you better be scared not to do whatever it takes to do what that chance is." And, you know, what I found out about Alcoholics Anonymous and running into people like I was that day that was pickable, because that's what I say about people when I see that in them, they're pickable. They're ready. They're ready to be in a place where they don't expect to hear something that they're going to hear that is going to plant the mustard seed of hope in their heart that despite no matter what defense they put up, it will not be strong enough to hold out that hope. And that happened to me because I was in that jail, and first 28 days is 23-hour lockup. 29th day, they move you to another block where it's a little more free. I go to that block. They say, "You can go to your first AA meeting if you want." I am excited. I'm going to this AA meeting. I go down to this AA meeting in the library. I walk in the doors. I look up, and who's chairing the meeting but a guy I sponsored for 7 years that I took into that jail for the jail commitment. And I left and relapsed, and he stayed keeping the jail commitment, still chairing the meeting. And here I am on the other side walking in, and he's the guy chairing the meeting. You want to talk about some humiliation? And I'm here to report to you that, regardless of what my thoughts were, that he walked up to me, because I can assure you those thoughts were basically that he was going to let me have it about a lot of stuff. That when he got to me and put his arms out and hugged me and kissed me on the cheek, I didn't know it then, but I know it now. He whispered the words in my ears that saved my life. That had everything to do with why I'm standing in front of you right now. And it was one simple sentence. He just whispered in my ear, "I am really glad to see that God has decided to sit you down and have another talk with you." I was like, And I went back to my cell at night instead of being the victim in self-pity to what was going on in my life. I had a little different thought, and that thought was, "You know what, Jim? You're sitting dead square in the beginning of the miracle, because sometimes the beginning of the miracle is not pleasurable. Sometimes the beginning near a miracle is being stripped naked of everything, so I have no choice but to open a piece in me to something greater than me, to beg or make conversation or do whatever I need to do as a starting point to it being different than the way it used to be." And I'm here to report to you that I haven't looked back since. And I became totally willing to come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and not feel like I was sentenced here. As a matter of fact, when I was sitting in that jail cell, not being able to go to meetings, I was kind of hoping I did get sentenced. Again, it was going to be different if I did. Because I had a chance to take a look at back at what I did at Alcoholics Anonymous previously, thinking I was sentenced and having a problem with it. I was more than willing to be sentenced this past time. Please send me. Tell me I got to go. Do whatever you got to do. Just get me there. So that I can start to have a different experience at REO. And it happened for me. You know, I went from that jail to a rehab, from that rehab to a halfway house, from that halfway house to sober living. And I could clearly see today that I was hand-delivered from person to person that would enter my life and show me what Alcoholics Anonymous was like. Someone that would 12-step me in that halfway house. Someone that would ask me some real important questions. One like, what the hell were you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous the first time that after about 10 years of taking a drink became a good idea? But for some reason, I had an inability to even ask myself that question. You know, I would find a sponsor there who would teach me two really valuable things. First one would be the importance of me firing myself as manager in my own life. Jimmy, do a horrible job of managing your life. Get out the way. Fire yourself. Right? And that was really, really huge. And the other thing was not only to have a sponsor, but to be sponsorable. Big difference. You know, to really be willing to grow so what I feel or what I think or what I think I know. I'm glad we read the set-aside prayer. You know, really beautiful prayer. Use it often. Set aside everything, anything I may think I know, and make the move behind the collective wisdom of something greater than me, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, its steps, its design for living, a sponsor who's been through it, a support group of people who are spiritually fit in their life. I start doing what they tell me to do. I at least start running by what my thinking is. You know, I start to do things in a whole different way. I don't try to take this all on myself. And I get in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm standing a chance. And that's all I am, is standing a chance. Because I still don't come to an understanding yet of how much work that I'll still always have to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, how do I figure out? How do I figure out that the hard way in Alcoholics Anonymous, why I think I've done the work? You know, I get through these steps with my sponsor, and my sponsor hints me to like some really important stuff that at the time he tells it to me, I'm like, yeah. But as life goes on and I stay sober and I start to become somebody and I get titles in my life and I get things in my life and I have this life that I need to manage, because now it's not even about drinking anymore. It's about the management of my life and what I do in the world around me and how do I interact and am I helping others? Am I not hurting anybody? And you know, how this thing looks in my life every day as far as who I am spiritually. And my sponsor keys me into things like, you know, don't forget 6 and 7 are the forgotten steps. Yeah, I know that. That 10-step inventory and that 11-step is really important daily. Yeah, I know. And all of a sudden, I'm full steam ahead, and I'm becoming everything in AA, and I'm at this podium, and I'm sponsoring this guy, and I'm chairing this meeting, and I'm doing this, and I'm running a million miles in Alcoholics Anonymous thinking if I'm not somewhere, I'm going to miss something, you know? And without my underlying ego and selfishness comes back to, you know, yeah, it feels good to be validated that you're doing great, Jim. And yeah, look at the way people are looking at you. And yeah, you do got your shit together, Jim. Yeah, right. And I'm off and I'm running and my intentions are well. My intentions are well. I'm not waking up on any given day saying, look, I think I'll go sabotage my sobriety and drink again. You know? But the cunning, baffling, and powerfulness of this problem when left untreated in a daily reprieve shows back up in my life. And it usually shows up through 6 and 7, which I leave unattended. And I don't know about you guys, but it always shows up for me in romances and finances. It's either me looking at a girl some certain type of way, trying to get with her in a certain type of way, trying to have her get with me in a certain type of way. Or I'm chasing security with money, you know, and I don't know about you guys. I'm a real alcoholic. I usually get them both going at the same time. I can't be a, like a one pick kind of guy. It's like, all right, if I got this one going, let's get this one going on too, make it really exciting, right? And I find myself at 9 years sober in a fetal position on my couch, saying to myself, God, what did I do? I'm like out of my mind. I'm sober. I'm out of my mind. I'm hurting everything. I'm the alcoholic living a double life sober. I'm this counselor that works with adolescents, and I got these degrees, and everything's going so great, and I put on this show for everybody how well my life is, and then I shut shop down, and I'm in this sick relationship that I'm trying to keep a secret from everybody, and I'm hurting this girl, and she don't want nothing to do with me, and the more she don't want me to do with me, the more I want something to do with her. And we know how we do, right? And I find myself in a fetal position on the couch, not wanting to drink, but wanting to hurt something. And I'm one of them that I want to hurt. And I'm on my couch begging God, please, man, help me. Just give me a message. Tell me to do something. I can't be like this too much longer. Or I'm going to reach for a solution, and I'm reaching to you. And he answers. And he says, let me pack a bag and go to Easton. Stay down there for a week. Get away from this situation. Go get with people you know that are sober down in Easton. Tell them your problem, and let the collective wisdom of them give you some advice and feedback about what maybe you should do. And I trust that process, and I come and do it. Somehow or another, through that move, I eventually wind up moving back down here and get my new attempt at my sobriety along the way, and I get to walk around in Alcoholics Anonymous learning from that past experience sober about another thing that I shouldn't do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had so many spiritual awakenings from some of my heroes in AA that take podiums with like 35, 40 years sober, and they get up here and they open their life up like an open book and talk about how hard they got to work at the fact that after 35 years, there's times when they still show up. And they need this program on a daily basis because they don't want to walk around thinking they want to stay sober on the quantity of their time, but it's more about the quality of their time. And that's how I try to live my life today, and God has held me to the test because probably about a year ago, I ran into some financial issues, and some things weren't working out, and I followed what they told me to do through it all. I give it to God every day. I talk to other alcoholics, and I try to throw myself deeper in the help of another alcoholic or the program as a whole. And it just got revealed to me not so long ago that, my mom and my dad, who are elderly, my dad has Alzheimer's and dementia, and my mom's falling apart being his caretaker. I kind of hear the message indirectly through God, Jim, maybe you should move in with them and help them. Maybe you should go and do the hard work they can't do. Change the light bulbs they can't change. Cook dinner for them because it's tough for them to cook. Wash some dishes because it's a lot to wash dishes. For my mom and dad. Maybe it's just I can talk to my dad so he quits asking my mom the same question. Maybe it's over Christmas I can put him in the car and take him to some of the loving people I know that invite me into their home and invite my parents. And maybe it's really about God asking me to finally be there in a way that is thoughtful and that it can keep me right-sized in what my relationship with God is about. And that's where my life is today. And I'm here to report to you that it's not a problem. I am here to report to you that it is an adjustment. But I have to remember anytime anything was ever an adjustment in my life, I always called it a problem. And I don't see it that way today. I see it as though if I'm in the position of availability to do it, that's what God would have me do. I get my footwork on, I try to do it. And I learn in a greater depth and understanding of what a relationship with a power greater than myself is and how I can be a service to the world around me and to keep my primary purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous through it, why I continue to learn about myself. Because I will guarantee you, what I've gotten from AA over these last couple years is I will never stop learning about myself through this relationship with a power greater than myself. And today I don't look at that as a problem. Today I look at that as opportunity. And And that's one thing that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that I'm so very grateful for, and that is opportunity and understanding. You know, not only do I see this opportunity, I start doing it, the understanding comes of how to pull it off and how to be okay with it while I'm pulling it off. And you know what? I can't ask for anything more than that. For me, that's a great day in AA and a great day in a relationship with a higher power. Thanks for letting me share.